making sure we don't, you know, we got to measure two or three times and cut once because we don't want to cut the wrong way, that maybe we should just take some time to see how this plays out a little bit before we decide to regulate, or at least regulate and really put a significant regulatory infrastructure.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast with Sanjay Puri. AI is changing the world faster than rules can keep up. So how do we protect people without killing progress? Each week, Sanjay brings you inside conversations with global leaders, policymakers, and innovators who are wrestling with that exact question. So if you're curious about the future of technology and how it's governed, you're in the right place. Joining us on the podcast today is Mike Hilgers, Attorney General of Nebraska. With extensive experience in law and public service, he's been at the forefront of shaping policy that balances innovation with accountability. His perspective on governance and the role of states in regulating AI is sure to add great depth to this conversation.
Attorney General Hilgers, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sanjay. Looking forward to the conversation today.
Just briefly, can you explain to our audience what does an AG in a state do? That would be a good beginning.
Sure. It depends on the state, Sanjay. And in fact, there are more than 50. There are 50 states, but there actually are more than 50 AGs in the country. Guam has one. Some of the territories have one. But and they're all different. But generally speaking, the attorney general in a given state, certainly in Nebraska, is the chief law enforcement officer of the state. So they are usually tasked, as we are in Nebraska, with criminal enforcement responsibilities, prosecution responsibilities, the chief lawyer for the state, when the state gets sued, maybe. Also, very frequently, certainly in Nebraska, a big part of our responsibilities, we are the kind of the chief consumer watchdog in the state. So if companies, whether they're tech or otherwise, are misleading customers or defrauding customers or scamming customers, we're usually the front line there. And then we do a lot of advice and guidance to various state agencies, and we usually handle a lot of constitutional issues. So there's more to our portfolio than just that, but sort of the top lawyer in the state is the way I describe it.
The top lawyer in the state, and I think this role is becoming, at least from the past few years, I've seen more and more visible as a lot of issues keep coming up, which we will discuss. AG, you had a remarkable journey, as I said in my beginning, from entrepreneur to legislative leader to chief law enforcement officer with a vast, diverse background. And now you generated this real focus on AI-generated exploitation as a priority issue. How has your background brought you to this perspective? And how did you recognize this as an emerging threat that really needed immediate attention?
Now, it's a great question, Sanjay. Probably different threads kind of coalesced into one. Part of my background is just as an entrepreneur, and for your listeners who are founders, it's one of the toughest jobs that there is. And I think the defining characteristic of most founders are that they are nimble and they are just laser focused on solving problems. As a former speaker, as a speaker of the Nebraska legislature, and as a former senator, being able to work and listen and sort of like collaborate, I think it was a big part of what I did day to day. So that was another part of my background that helped me get to this point. I was an IP lawyer in the past, so I've got sort of a background of thinking about tech issues and emerging technologies. And then being the attorney general, and as I mentioned, part of my role is to oversee a criminal prosecution unit. I really saw sort of the dangers and evils of human trafficking firsthand. The dangers and evils of CSAM firsthand. And you start to put all those things together, the desire to solve problems, the desire to protect children, protect Nebraskans, seeing this emerging technology and saying, hey, we really have to act, and we have to act now. There's almost a moral imperative to do so. All those things kind of came together. And the good news is we have a lot of other very committed public servants who saw the same problem, and building a large coalition, I think, led from that.
So for our audience who might not be as aware of this issue, AG, can you help our listeners understand the scope of the AI child exploitation problem? What specific capabilities of AI technology make it particularly dangerous for children?
Oh, that's a great question. So let me try to describe it, kind of comparing pre-AI to under AI. Pre-AI, I mean, CSAM is frankly It's terrible material. It's evil. It's very exploitative. In a pre-AI world, generally speaking, CSAM is tied to a specifically exploited child. It's not easy and without AI tools to sort of create lifelike CSAM material that's not tied to a child. And so in a pre-AI world, you're looking at very directly exploiting one specific, potentially known child. Maybe the volume is large or can be large, very sad to say, but maybe not at the level that we might see in an AI world. So that's kind of the pre-AI world. Certainly prosecuting those cases can be difficult. We put a lot of resources across the state into prosecuting those cases. But they typically have known victims, and we can actually do a lot in that context. In the AI world, there's some key differences. Certainly, the material might be similar, but as I mentioned, in an AI world, you may actually have the images themselves may not be directly tied, but certainly are derived from, because these models are trained on the actual images of real children. But also, the volume is so high, and so it makes it very difficult for criminal law enforcement officials, whether it's my office or our local sheriffs or county attorneys, to really be able to sift through some of these CSAM materials at such a, when it's with the tools that we have had, when it's at such a high volume. And so one of the things we did in the Nebraska legislature is we advocated for, helped introduce a bill to help expand our tools and really make it this type of AI generated CSAM unlawful, to ensure that our law enforcement officials have the tools to be able to hold these types of people accountable.
So, AG, you're saying the speed and the scale at which AI does this makes it really, really difficult because you have limited resources to do this. And you said Nebraska passed a bill, I think you're talking about LB 383, which prohibits AI-generated CSAM. Just walk our audience through this, because there might be your colleagues listening in around the country who are looking at this or are looking at it, and maybe in countries elsewhere. What is this bill about?
Yeah, so great question. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. So I should have said the speed and scale, but also the laws are different when they apply differently in an AI context. So without LB 383, our previous law really was designed to meet the moment that we've had over the last several decades. In other words, this pre-AI world that I described, we actually have a known victim or a victim that can be identified. That is what really our criminal laws were designed to do. The idea of having AI-generated CSAM where it's not immediately tied back to a child, a specific child, although, as I mentioned, with these models are certainly trained on child images, the laws need to catch up. These specific laws need to catch up. And so some of the concern that we had in Nebraska was that unless we modified our criminal statute in order to cover CSAM, AI-generated CSAM, then without that, it might make it more difficult for us to actually prosecute these individuals, which then has all sorts of downstream implications for our ability to even investigate these things. If you don't have an ultimate criminal statute, it can be hard to investigate. So what we did was just catch our criminal law up with this new AI reality. And hopefully it's a model for other states or other, your listeners in other countries to look at their own laws and say, hey, have our penal laws, our criminal code, have they caught up with this technology? And LB 383, I think, is a really good example. If they haven't, they can use that as a model to start thinking about how they can update their own laws in order to cover this particular instance.
So that's very helpful for our listeners, especially overseas. You touched on a point which was brought up to us by one of our listeners and said, you know, AI technology, AG, is evolving so rapidly. I mean, if we did this show maybe 6 months from now, I'd be asking probably about something completely different. But legal frameworks, as you very well know, take time to develop. How do we bridge this gap? This has been asked by one of our members here, audience members.
Well, it's an amazing question because honestly, the AI technology is maybe the most exciting technology in my time. Now, once we have AI in place, who knows what kind of inventions and innovations we'll see in 10 or 15 years. Still waiting for my Jetsons flying car and teleportation. But it's incredibly exciting. And to your point, Sanjay, you're exactly right. It may be the fastest moving technology I've seen in my lifetime. I mean, it wasn't maybe even a year ago, we hadn't even heard of DeepSeek and its models out of China. On any given day, you're seeing a new model come out, leapfrogging an old model. You're seeing new capabilities. It's incredible. And so everyone will sort of approach this question from a different perspective and may reach a slightly different answer. I'll just tell you, Sanjay, how I've evaluated up to this point. And that is really when you're trying to balance innovation and regulation in this context, I think I err on the side of ensuring that we have more innovation and not putting too much drag via regulation on this early stage of developing the models. And I say that for a few different reasons. One reason is that I think we are in a really significant global competition. By all accounts, China in particular is just sort of on the heels of the United States in terms of the model development. Certainly the US with NVIDIA has been on the forefront of the chip development. But I think it's critically important, at least here in the United States, and I think in the free world, in order for the AI stack to be, that race to be won by the United States, and that the AI stack really be top to bottom, be an American stack. And I think hopefully we are never in a hot war. Hopefully we're not in any sort of like global conflict, but certainly I think ensuring that the predominant technology, and you know how these technological battles play out. I mean, ever since the VHS beta, I mean, people understand once you have a predominant technology, that is the one that has really the pole position to be adopted by others. And that's where the investment resources go. That's where the development resources go. And so I think it's really important, I think, for the American technology stack or Western technology stack, I guess, even if you were to expand it beyond the United States, is the predominant one. In order to do that with this, we are literally sprinting against China to see who wins. And I think if you put too much drag on that regulatory structure, you increase the likelihood that you will lose that race. And so at this stage, my view has been that I think we ought to be awfully careful about putting too much regulation, especially on such a fast-moving technology, in a way that might really inhibit our progress. Now, the other part of that is that I think if you look at our history, Sanjay, in other emerging technology areas, we don't exactly have the greatest history when we try to be very prescriptive about our regulations of actually hitting the mark. Let me give you one example that I'm dealing with as Attorney General just today, and that is online internet access to certain sites for children. So there was a statute passed federally called COPPA, Child Online Privacy Protection Act, and that at the time, it sort of set this age threshold to viewing certain content and getting and meeting parental consent to get onto websites at under 13. And that really set sort of, that was the regulatory framework that we still are living under today. And I think the data is in when it comes to social media that was a bad decision. That was the wrong decision, that we have 13, 14, 15, 16 year old boys and girls in particular, who have had really been harmed by a lot of this online content. And that if we were to redo the regulatory structure today, maybe we would have come out with an actual different structure. And the problem is, once a regulation or a law is in place, it becomes very difficult to change. Not impossible, but very difficult. And that's certainly true at the federal level. And so I just think between those two things, the need to innovate and iterate quickly to win this particular race, and secondly, making sure we don't, you know, we got to measure two or three times and cut once because we don't want to cut the wrong way, that maybe we should just take some time to see how this plays out a little bit before we decide to regulate, or at least regulate and really put a significant regulatory infrastructure in place. So that's how I've come out on that particular question. Of course, the devil's in the details, Sanjay.
So that leads to several great pivot points, AG. One of them was recently we had the big, beautiful bill, which had a potential provision to ban state regulation for 10 years or so. It did not go through, and there are still people who say that we need something of that nature because there are states, many states that are considering, whether you look at Connecticut, California, et cetera. You have said you come out on the side of innovation. We are in a geopolitical world where innovation is going to drive so much benefits for our country. How do you view the federal state? Because we could end up with patchwork of laws. Some of those states, and I've had some of them, governors and others here saying, hey, we can't wait forever for the federal government to get its act together. So your perspective on this, AG?
Well, as you mentioned, I did not support I actually thought on balance that having the prohibition actually made a better public policy sense. Let me take a step back and just explain to your viewers and listeners sort of my philosophy on this particular question in general, and then why I came out in the position that I did. In general, I am a states' rights person. So the United States, for those listeners outside of the U.S., we are we're a country with 50 sovereign states, with one federal government. Our Constitution gives the states a significant amount of power. I'm a jealous protector of that power. I think states are truly the laboratory of democracy. I want to ensure that the power is closest to the people. And I'd rather in Nebraska that decisions are made that impact Nebraskans, that those decisions are made by Nebraskans who ideally are politically accountable to the electorate. I also am very sympathetic to those who are frustrated with Congress acting or really not acting on a whole host of really difficult policy issues facing the United States. So coming into this discussion, my sort of priors, as it were, would be, yeah, let's let the states innovate. I don't think that is not where I came out on this particular question. Let me just give you a couple of reasons why. The first reason is a little bit of a bias towards ensuring that we have a national standard. The federal government in the United States under the Constitution has a limited set of powers. For those of your listeners outside of the U.S., they may be like, really? Seems like they have a lot of power. But the truth is, under the Constitution, they have a limited set. But one of those powers, which is right there in the text, is that they have the power to regulate interstate commerce. And one of the places where you really need federal regulation is the means of commerce across states. And so think about the long history in this country of the federal government regulating the means of commerce. So for instance, for railroads. So railroad gauges can differ in size. You don't want to have one state have a certain size of a gauge that's different from another, adds friction and drag to the process. Same thing with semi-trucks driving on the highways, the interstate highways. We don't want states mandating different sizes of semi-trucks. So if you go from Nebraska into Iowa, they've got to get out and make some changes. So there is actually a pretty strong argument that for the means of commerce, we should have a federal standard. I also think, Sanjay, in this particular instance, that some of the data points that I've seen in the technological environment some states have really gotten very aggressive, and I think they've been captured by very extreme interests, most often, I think, on the progressive side, where they have made, I think, maybe some values-based determinations as to how they want to regulate things like the tech industry, that I think are inconsistent with how I would like to see some of these particular means of commerce be regulated. So for instance, I'll give you a small example. And the problem, by the way, is not just the patchwork, but it is one state really dictating to the others. And so for instance, when the FCC a couple of years ago decided that they didn't want to have a net neutrality, that they got rid of net neutrality, you may remember that. Some states, including Nebraska, but in particular California, really wanted to dictate their own net neutrality standard across the United States. And we've seen, we don't want one state to dictate nationally. And by the way, I don't think these companies are going to have patchwork states. So they'll probably comply with the most restrictive state and just have that as the national standard. We've also seen states like California and other contexts actually put forward pretty aggressive, and I think very short-sighted policies in non-tech areas in particular. And so I just, on balance, I could see those who say, hey, let's let the states innovate. But I think on balance, I think the importance of winning the innovation race in AI, the risk that some states might really get involved in a way on an emerging technology, maybe they don't fully understand or maybe can see sort of around the corner on, maybe could really restrict our ability to develop this technology as fast and as well as we thought we can. And maybe make some decisions, like I mentioned before with COPPA, that we might really come to regret in 2 or 3 years as this technology unfolds.
You know, social media and some of these things, how should we hold major tech companies accountable while encouraging innovation? Because we see the same movie happening again in AI a little bit, where you have, because of the intense cost in this whole equation, you see 4, 5, 6 companies that are going to dominate this sphere. And AI might be even more significant in our daily lives, in our healthcare and everything else, than even social media. So how should we do that?
It's a great question. And by my previous comments, I want to make sure your listeners and viewers understand that I do not trust a total free-for-all for a lot of these big tech companies. We've in Nebraska been really leading the fight against several of these large companies in the social media context. And our lived experience here in Nebraska is that a lot of these companies, if you just let them go to the free market, that they will do a lot of things that will be very harmful to children. We've seen that with a major lawsuit that we filed against TikTok or Meta, that they may unfortunately use their power for particular political or partisan or ideological ends. They may suppress free speech. They may amplify certain ideological voices. So I do look at it with a very sort of a little bit of a jaded eye for some of these large tech companies. And I do think it's very important for us to be very thoughtful about ensuring that we don't, you know, end up in a world in which we have 4, 5, 6, whatever the number might be, Sanjay, of really unstoppable tech companies that eclipse the power of all of the major regulators, whether it's the state attorney general or even the United States Department of Justice. I don't have the perfect answer to that, but let me give you at least a couple starting points. I certainly think one set of tools already exists in our hands, whether it's the state or federal government, and that is consumer protection. I mean, we're starting to see some things with AI psychosis, AI prompted psychosis. I think that's been in the news a little bit lately. Certainly, we want AI companies to protect privacy. There's robust privacy protections around the country. We want to make sure that they're telling customers and users of those software that they the truth. And so if they say one thing about how they're going to use their data, they better do that and not actually use their data for other types of purposes. I do think also we have maybe some structural analogs that we can pull from other technology areas that we could start to use to think about it. How to regulate an AI, because I do think they have to be structural changes if we get to that regulatory point. So for instance, in the social media context, the data tells us that, you know, really kids 16 or younger shouldn't be using it. That's where we see a lot of the mental health problems. And so states like Nebraska have passed laws saying, hey, look, you got to have an age verification. Some of those have been challenged. But the point is that's a structural change. Now, I'm not advocating and saying you have to be 18 to use AI. But my point is, I think we have to be focus on the structural, in particular because of the intellectual or the technical complexity of these issues. I think we have to look at structural, really sort of robust, fundamental regulatory changes that are regulations that are kind of a really strong baseline that no matter whatever the innovation is on AI over the next 5 or 7 years, kind of don't become rapidly scaled now or stale. The issue that then I've so part of the reason I've advocated for pausing a little bit, Sanjay, is we don't know what those are.
Are colleagues of yours or other policy leaders, not just in the US and the rest of the world, aware of what's happening at such a fast pace? That's the one worry that I have, is making sure that leaders know, because you can only regulate if you know what you're regulating. That's one. And then you're also dealing with these companies who have such massive resources to put. These companies do a lot of good too. I mean, we in the United States have benefited from a lot of the innovations these companies do, but there has to be a balance. So any thoughts on the education, awareness of policy leaders and the resources, under-resourced policy leaders, over-resourced tech companies?
This applies if you're a policymaker, if you're a student, if you're a kid, if you are in a job today. I try to tell everyone, AI, learn as much as you possibly can to protect yourself against the future. If you're in a job right now, you want to make sure that you have that job, you continue to remain valuable to your company, learn AI tools. If you're in school and you're thinking about what your future is, think about what AI might disrupt sooner than later and make sure that you're thinking about that as you make your decisions. It is absolutely true as well for policymakers. I think it's enormously, enormously important. I try to tell people all the time, we had technological disruptions in my lifetime. I was born in 1978. I remember when the internet came online. I remember when Y2K happened. I remember people thinking that, oh gosh, the internet's going to do all these amazing things and we'll have that Jetsons flying car. It has been incredibly disruptive over time. I mean, if you compare 1999 to what we have in 2025, I mean, the world has changed. But I do not think that the internet, as powerful as it's been and as important to productivity as it has been, will really hold a candle to the changes that we will see and have from AI. And so you just got to keep talking about it. And some people just won't fully engage. And I think it's a missed opportunity. More than anything, Sanjay, I think we should look at the opportunities here, by the way. I think a lot of it's threat. We think about the threats, we think about the downside.
AG, you said you're the chief law enforcement officer. From a law enforcement standpoint, are there any unique challenges in prosecuting AI-generated cases compared to traditional crimes?
I mean, especially how powerful these models have gotten. I mean, a lot of the CSAM material can, you know, look like a real victim. I mean, again, they're children victimized through the use of the models to create the particular picture, but or the CSAM. But I think that makes it difficult. And I think the volume combined with the fact that you don't know whether or not you have a victim, a specific victim you can go and interview and talk to right at the outset. So I do think those present some unique challenges in the law enforcement context. Of course, we see in other parts of our world, in the consumer protection, and which also touches on law enforcement, the impact of AI when it comes to scam and fraud. I mean, one of the things we've seen maybe an exponential rise in are the use of really brazen actors using AI tools to defraud people. I mean, the stories of a grandmother getting a call from a voice that sounds like her granddaughter who says that she's in a jail and needs $1,000 sent via Bitcoin. I mean, these are extraordinarily powerful tools. And so we see that a lot. And unfortunately, people are using these AI tools to fraud and scam people around our state, certainly.
AG, should individuals have a right to sue when AI systems cause them harm, primarily around the issues of deepfake or privacy violations?
We have data privacy protections in the United States, certainly GDPR in Europe. There are a lot of strong privacy protections. Those should apply whether we're in a non-AI world or in an AI world. I think some things like consumer protection also apply in a non-AI world versus an AI world. I think AI companies have to be honest to their customers, just like non-AI companies have to be honest to customers. I think there's another set of problems, legal questions that we're still sorting through what the answer is. So think about intellectual property. What happens if an AI creates something new that would fall under the copyright? Who owns that? What about a patent? Who owns that? How do you deal with co-inventorship issues? And so I think these are really really important, but also fascinating legal questions that we are going to be having to grapple with for the next 2 or 3 years. But yes, I think consumers absolutely ought to have the same kinds of tools that they have today. The real question, I think, Sanjay, for you and then your questioner is, over the next 3 years, depending on where AI goes, are we going to need to expand those tools? Are there new things that we haven't thought about? I mean, think data privacy. I mean, HIPAA has been a thing for a long time. Protection for your global listeners, protection to your private information as a patient, as a medical patient. That's protecting the United States. The idea of data privacy and data security is relatively, in the history of at least our country, is a relatively new phenomenon. It really kind of really took off with the advent of the internet and use of computer. And so if you would have asked someone 80 years ago about data privacy, they would have looked at you and sort of like thought you were crazy and from the future. But so let's see what I think we need to be open-minded about the world's going to look like. But let's start with some first principles that we know work. We know have worked, and let's apply those and start there. I don't think consumers are defenseless, nor do I think that they should be.
Agentic AI, it's everywhere. These are autonomous systems that can act on behalf of individuals, organizations. How does it impact any risks that we have to regulate against? Because I had the chief AI officer of one of the largest cybersecurity company in the world, and he says one of his nightmares is rogue agents that, you know, can go rogue internally within a company, et cetera. So, I mean, and this is one of the largest cybersecurity companies in the world. So when you look at agents, do you think from a law enforcement or regulation perspective, anything that comes to your mind that worries you?
Let me start with, I think, the innovative potential of agents. I mean, I think when harnessed correctly, and we're just going to continue to see new use cases, you know, every day, and it's pretty exciting to see. I mean, the ability of use of having an agentic architecture or system for your own organization is, I hate the word game changer. It's a phrase that we use in the U.S. a lot. It seems very cliche. It feels like using that here undersells the power of agents. So I think it's an extraordinarily exciting technology. Having said that, whether it's rogue or broken or sort of an agent that doesn't work as designed, there are absolute major concerns, because what you're doing is you're taking the ability to scale scale good things in the context of innovation or a company trying to be more productive. But in this case, you also can scale really bad things, and you can scale them very quickly. And so maybe that's an broken architecture inside of a system that that wreaks havoc. So the person you were talking about within their own organization, but also in the hands of malevolent actors who want to scale scams or want to be able to scale phishing attacks or intrusions into data repositories to be able to get people's information. So I certainly do think that there's real risks there. I do think, as I said before, kind of my framework of looking at these things, I think we want to be a little soft touch on the regulation. I think people need to be awfully, awfully careful and thoughtful and as they put together their own agents for their organization. So I do think they need to be careful. I also think like some of our tools probably do work. I think if you've got our legal tools, so if you are using a system and building agents for your own organization, it goes haywire. Well, if it's gone haywire because the company, the vendor, didn't give you what they promised, well, you've got some legal protection there. You've got the opportunity to breach a contract. Maybe there's a fraud suit. We have some similar tools where people are using agents to be able to, whether it's hack or violate someone's privacy. We have law enforcement and other tools. I really think it remains a little bit to be seen exactly how those unfold. To some degree, some of this is not a difference in kind, it's a difference in volume. But I do think as rapidly as this has been developing in the next 6 months or a year, my answer might be slightly different. I might say, oh my gosh, these agents are really out of control and we need to think through something structurally just to kind of rein them in. But I don't think we're at that point yet, but everyone should be cautious, whether you're building a company, running an organization, or in a world where you think your systems are exposed to malevolent agents.
AG, I live in Washington, D.C. Here, the two parties can't even agree if the sun is out in many cases. And you built a bipartisan coalition of 54 AGs for the CSAM issue that you had.
I think when you take the politics out of it and you just look at it, you say, hey, let's actually help protect kids. In applying some limited regulation to help really make sure that this particular use of AI is curtailed, I think people really rallied around that. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that actually, at the end of the day, most people want the same things. People want, whether you're Republican or Democrat or otherwise, you want kids to be protected. And so I think it really kind of hit the trifecta of hitting an issue that people were passionate about, AI, they wanted to do something, but also really helping protect kids, help support law enforcement. So I think there wasn't any other magic to it. I certainly think, though, as people think through these really difficult problems, sitting down, really understanding the issue, AI is extraordinarily complicated. The idea that you could pick this up with a briefing book in 4 hours, I think, is probably missing the mark. And I think really, as much as possible, given the demands in our time, immersing ourselves in these issues, really trying to understand the pros and cons of these things, reasoning from first principles, and then listening to experts, listening to trusted voices and to other stakeholders, I think we'll get to the right result. And I think it can be bipartisan. I think it really needs to be, because I think ultimately we want something that's durable and smart and lasting. And I think the way to get there is by doing at least some of the things that I just talked about. So hopefully our policymakers in DC can do that. I've got hope that they will. Certainly the issue is extraordinarily critical for us to get right. We've got to win the AI race. We've got to get any regulation right. And so we're putting a lot of trust in them that they'll do it, and hopefully that's what we'll see.
Well, watching what other states, specifically Colorado, California, are doing, watching what Washington is doing, and just staying on top of technology, that I think is pretty important. Okay, federal or state leadership on AI regulation?
Federal.
Okay, innovation or safety first? I'm going to give you some tricky ones, AJ.
Innovation.
Okay. Voluntary industry standards or mandatory regulations?
It feels like a deposition where I have to answer one or the other, but I can't say something else.
Well, you can say something else too.
I think it depends. Probably a little bit of a mix of both, honestly. I think there's going to be places where we will absolutely want mandatory, and then I think others are voluntary. I think what would be nice also early would be voluntary. That might ultimately, we see which ones really matter, and then we can maybe bake those as mandatory later. So I would say on those two different, that's what I would say on those. I think it's a mix.
Okay. AI liability, is it on companies or on users?
Depending on the issue, both. Absolutely. I think there are instances where users can use the tool in a way that could create liability for themselves, just like they can on, think about X. If you get on X and you defame somebody, it's not X's fault that you defame somebody, it's your fault that you defame somebody. But I certainly think that there's also liability for some of these core issues on the companies themselves.
Okay. Global AI governance, is it possible or is it a pipe dream?
I think it's a pipe dream. I think it's a pipe dream.
Okay. Is AI in criminal justice, is it a promise or a peril?
You say that again, AI criminal justice?
Use of artificial intelligence in criminal justice, is it an opportunity or is that a problem, do you think?
Using AI in criminal justice is a huge opportunity. It's a huge opportunity on both sides. On the actual law enforcement, the investigation side, but I think on the rehabilitative side, on the actual custody side, so that's three sides. So I guess I said both, but three. I think it's an enormous opportunity. And in fact, I think it's an enormous opportunity for almost every aspect of government.
Wow. Finally, your confidence level in current AI governance standards on a scale of 1 to 10.
Oh my gosh, probably TBD. I mean, I think the current standards are working for as of today, but it's hard to say. I mean, we could look back at 3 years and I could be wrong.
For everything, almost everything.
That's right.
That's so true. That is so true. AG, it's been fantastic to have you on the podcast. Your leadership really around child AI safety shows what's possible, you know, when we put protecting the vulnerable first while we still embrace innovation. And your work really demonstrates that effective AI governance requires collaboration, as you said, across party lines and between state and federal and amongst diverse stakeholders. And so thank you for joining us and for your continued leadership. And to our listeners, as AG has shown, AI regulation is not just a technical challenge, it's a moral imperative. Thank you so much for being on the Regulating AI podcast.
That was an honor, Sanjay. Thank you so much. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate you and all your listeners and viewers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI podcast with Sanjay Puri. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to leave a comment. We'd love to hear what you thought. Share it with someone curious about the future of AI and join us next time for more stories and insights from the leaders shaping what's ahead. Right here on the Regulating AI podcast.